the title of my talk gives you the promise of a Gulliver travel. So to begin with, let's start with Lilliput. And viewed from Lyon, Lilliput looks like this. So what you can see here is a square chamber that is 1 centimeter wide. And the chamber is filled by a monolayer of colloidal particles that have a diameter of about 5 microns. And as it turns out, we found a way to motorize those inert particles and to turn them into motile bodies. So it's pretty simple. In practice, it's as simple as hitting a key on a keyboard. And very quickly, the system self-organizes as the particles propel themselves, they interact. And very quickly, they self-assemble into this fluid, which flows spontaneously and which eventually, self-organizes into this unique vortex pattern that is very stable at system spanning scales. So I do apologize for you guys who might have already watched this movie quite a few times, but I like beginning my active matter talks with this movie because I feel that it gives you a very intuitive picture of what an active system is, that is to say, a system where all the particles are driven independently, and yet the system self-organizes into large-scale coherent dynamic structures. So what's in the first part of this talk? So first of all, I would like to tell you very briefly how we motorize the colloid and the colloidal particles. It's going to be one slide. And then I would like to convince you that by listening to sound propagations in these spontaneously flowing liquids, and by studying their response to external perturbations, you can learn a lot about their hydrodynamics. So first thing first, how do we motorize colloidal beads? So the idea consists in combining two tricks. The first one is known as the Quincke electrorotation phenomenon. Simply put, the idea is that if you apply a DC electric field on an insulating body immersed in a conducting fluid, the charges at the surface of the insulator forms a dipole, and this dipole points in the direction opposite to the field. That's one possible conformation. However, once you increase the field magnitude above a given threshold, the system actually jumps towards another steady state. The dipole makes a finite angle with the electric field, and as a result, the bead experiences an electrostatic torque, and it keeps on spinning at a steady rotation rate. So I'm not expecting you to get the essential mechanism that yields the spontaneous rotation. The only thing that you have to remember for today is that when you take an insulating body, you place it in a conducting fluid and you apply a strong electric field, spinning motion. That's it. Okay? Quincke discovered this phenomenon at the end of the 19th century. So that's trick one. Trick two is that when you take a body that rotates and when you place it on a solid surface, you can convert rotation into translation. That's how wheels have been constantly working for millennia. It works, right? That's the wheel, spinning, rotating body, solid surface, translation. And that's it, you're done. And it works, as you can clearly see it on this movie. So what you can see here is a dilute assembly of colloidal particles that roll on the surface of an electrode. So let me give you a couple of orders of magnitude. The diameter of the colloid is 5 micron, which is very small compared to the gap between the two electrodes, which is about 100 microns. And the typical voltage you need to apply to power these particles is of the order of 1 volt per micron. So what is even more important than self-propulsion is that the direction of the electric field that powers the particle points in the direction normal to the screen. In other words, the direction of the field does not set the direction of motion of the particles. And you can clearly see this on the histogram of the particle velocities. So the color indicates the probability of finding a particle at a velocity Vx, Vy. Clearly, the histogram is highly isotropic, and it's also peaked on a circle. And because the histogram is picked on a circle, you know that all the particles move at a constant speed over time and over the population, and this speed here is about 1 millimeter per second. So at our scale, the particles would finish a marathon in less than a couple of minutes. They are pretty fast. So that's basically an active gas. And as I have already showed you that, when you increase the concentration of particles, the particles interact, and the system undergoes a gas-liquid transition, and the system indeed forms a liquid that spontaneously flows in this channel. So here the geometry is that of a racetrack. You turn on the experiment, you observe a clockwise flow, you turn off, you observe a counterclockwise flow with an equal probability. That's a spontaneous symmetry breaking. And there is something that I do not want to do today. I do not want to tell you about the microscopic interactions between these particles. I don't want to tell you all the details about the hydrodynamic and the electrostatic interactions that promote the emergence of collective motion. Instead, I would like to describe this material that I'm going to refer to as a flock or polar liquid. I would like to describe this flock as a continuum material, as a regular fluid, just like the coffee that you might have had during the break. When you describe a fluid, and Jean-François mentioned something along those lines during his lecture, when you describe the flow of coffee in a coffee cup, you don't really want to deal with all the molecular interactions between the coffee and water and I don't know what molecules. You are happy with mass conservation. Coffee is incompressible. There's just a divergence of the velocity that is zero. And you're happy with momentum conservation. Here, the mass times the acceleration equals the sum of the forces acting locally in this fluid. And that's pretty convenient to have this hydrodynamic description. It's extremely convenient, especially because for all the fluids that you can think about, all the Newtonian fluid that you can think about, you have only one set of two simple equations, and the fluid is characterized only by two material parameters, the viscosity and the fluid density. Easy. So what about flocks? What about flocks assembled from self-propelled particles? Okay. Flocks are in general compressible, so you can write down mass conservation. It's not as simple as divergence of V equals zero, but you can live with that. You would live with that if you had to describe the flow of a passive gas, for instance. But the problem is that this flock moves on a substrate. And as it was mentioned during the end of the lecture just given by Jean-François, the system does not conserve momentum here. So you have to write down an equation for velocity that is not momentum conservation, and that's this equation. That's actually one of the earliest results of active matter physics. Horrendous. Horrible, right? Nobody wants to have a look at that at 5 p.m. or so, right? It's horrible, and you have to deal with 14 material constants. You don't want to do that. Not even in the morning. You don't want to do that. Okay, I know one person, two actually. They are very nice, okay? On the record. They're very nice. Indeed, John Toner and Yawai Tu derived from conservation using conservation laws and symmetry principle this equation more than 20 years ago. But it turns out that the equation is not that bad. It's actually pretty simple, especially when you get rid of most of the terms. If you forget about all the gradient terms, this equation tells you that the velocity relaxes in the Mexican hat potential. That's what this equation tells you. In other words, this equation tells you that the fluid wants to have a velocity with a non-zero magnitude, but the direction of the flow is not prescribed. That's the usual spontaneous symmetry breaking term. So let's now forget about this term, and let's have a look at the gradient terms, forgetting about anisotropy and forgetting some terms that are irrelevant to what I'm going to tell you about today. So this equation would then look like that. It's very similar to Navier-Stokes, right? You have something that looks very much like a convective derivative here, a viscous term, and this would be the pressure of an ideal gas. The pressure would be proportional to density. And this sigma would be the active gas compressibility, if you wish. So at the end of the day, Turner 2 hydrodynamics, the hydrodynamics of flux, is just Ginzburg-Landau and Navier-Stokes, but all together. And we are left with here five different material constants. It's not that complicated, but you really need now to find a way to measure these constants if you want to have a quantitative hydrodynamics, right? You want this, if you want these equations to be predictive, you need to find a way to measure these constants. So you might want to use a rheometer. The viscosity is usually measured with a rheometer. Here, it might be difficult. We have a 2D fluid, colloids, might be complicated. But on top of being just technically a technical challenge, it's just, strictly speaking, impossible to infer those coefficients with a rheometer, as this, these terms do not, you don't know how they relate to the stress that the rheometer walls would experience. And this convective term, there's absolutely no way that a rheometer can provide you this convective term. So now think about an even more dramatic situation. Think about the hydrodynamics of an actual flock, a flock of geese. You don't want to put a flock of geese in a rheometer, right? You don't do that, even in the Southwest, right? They torture geese, but one goose at a time, importantly. So impossible. So no rheology. So how can you do that? So what I would like to argue now is that you just have to watch it flow. But you need a color movie, though. And from now on, the color of the particles indicates the direction of propagation. Blue means moving up, red means moving down. And from this movie, you might already distinguish some fluctuations in the velocity. And if you have a good eyes, you might even see density fluctuations in this system. So if you don't see them, let me tell you that we did measure the density and velocity fluctuations in the system, and we did this, for instance, for a wave vector corresponding to propagation angle theta here and a given wavelength, and this corresponds to the power spectrum of the density in red and velocity fluctuations in blue. And clearly, these power spectra have two peaks, which means that two sound waves propagate in this system. One peak in the power spectrum indicates the propagation of sound wave. Here you have two peaks. You can repeat the procedure for all wavelengths. So this is now the wave vector. This is the frequency. The color indicates the amplitude of the fluctuations, of the velocity fluctuations. And you can see that the fluctuations are peaked on two lines. And these two lines are precisely the dispersion relations on the sound modes in this system. So first of all, the sound in an active fluid is very different than the sound that propagates in this very room. So first of all, we have two sound modes. The dispersion relation is not are not straight lines. So the two sound modes are dispersive waves. And in addition to this, the dispersion relation depends on the propagation angle. So this is for pi over 4. This is for the transverse direction. The dispersion relation depends on the direction of propagation. Good. So even though the dispersion relations are dispersive, you can fit them at the origin, and by doing so, you can define rigorously a speed of sound, and you can plot the variations of the speed of sound with the direction of propagation. So let me guide you from this unusual plot. The distance to the origin indicates the speed of sound. So this is the speed of sound for the blue mode, this is the speed of sound for the red mode, and you can just plot this, draw these plots by repeating the measurement for all possible propagation direction. And as it turns out, it's pretty easy to deduce the variations of the speed of sound from the ugly Turner 2 equations. And again, that's one of the earliest results of active matter physics. From Turner 2, you can deduce that the speed of sound in the system can be written like this. And it depends only on two hydrodynamic parameters, the convective term that I could not measure with a rheometer, and the liquid compressibility. So you can now compare this formula with your measurements, and it works pretty well. So by measuring the speed of sound in the system, you can actually have a direct measurement of the fluid compressibility and of these convective coefficients. So to make long story short, let me tell you that you can also look at the damping of the sound waves, and by doing so, you can actually measure all the hydrodynamic parameters of this active fluid. So you can, for instance, measure how the convective coefficient varies with the density, no variations. You can see that the compressibility, as you would have expected it, increases with the fluid density. And this viscous term or elastic term, depending on your community, you might want to call it elasticity or viscosity, you can see that it increases with density. This should be a kappa, by the way. And the blue lines turns out to be the theoretical prediction that we made deriving the hydrodynamic equation from the microscopic dynamics. That's probably something that you will not hear about during Jean-François' lecture, but it has been done by many people. The procedure is clear, and the agreement confirms that both the hydrodynamic form and our measurements are consistent. Good, so now we have a fluid, and we know how to characterize it quantitatively. So what can we do with it? So the fluid flows spontaneously, great. But what about its response to external perturbations? So far, I've mostly used this fluid analogy. But from now on, I would like to think about this material as a magnet. And it becomes pretty obvious that the analogy is meaningful when looking at the instantaneous velocities of the particles. You can see that all the velocities point along the same direction as would spin in a ferromagnetic phase. So the analogy is actually more accurate. You can show that the colloid, the orientation of the velocity maps on the spin of a ferromagnet, the local velocity field maps on the local magnetization. But what about the magnetic field? You need to know what would be the analogous of a magnetic field if you want to think about the response to external perturbations. To answer this question, we did a very simple experiment. We placed colloidal particles in a straight microfluidic channel, and we applied a solvent flow field on top of it. And spoiler alert, I'm going to call H the magnitude of the solvent flow. So let me recall first that the distribution, the histogram of the particle velocities in a gas phase is just isotropic and peaked on a circle. That's when the solvent flow is zero. If you now turn on the external flow, is it me? Yeah, it's me. I'm sorry about that. I'm very sorry. From Stockholm. Mm-hmm. Too bad. Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. So, here now the distribution is peaked on the same circle, but the distribution is biased. In other words, the particles align with the flow, keeping their speed constant. And you can clearly see this from these superimposed pictures. The particle aligns with the flow, keeping the speed constant. Okay, so now you can measure the magnetization of the system, or equivalently, the modulus of the average particle orientations. And you can plot the magnetization as a function of the field, the magnitude of the external field. That's what you get. And the black line is not a mere fit. That's actually a theoretical prediction. That's the magnetization of an isolated spin in an homogeneous magnetic field at finite temperature. You might want to describe this as a Langevin equation, but this is just the Boltzmann average of the magnetization of an isolated spin in a magnetic field. So we've got our analogy. The magnetic field is analogous to the solvent flow field in our polar active fluid. So if I give you a piece of a magnetic material, I guess that the first question you would like to ask me is, what's a magnetization curve? How does the magnetization vary when you apply an external field? And in particular, you might want to know whether the magnetization curve has an hysteresis loop. So just to make sure that we're all on the same page here, a hysteresis loop means that if you apply a field in this direction, you measure the magnetization, it goes from okay, my left to my right, reversed slowly the direction of the field, and I still can observe a magnetization pointing from my left to my right. That's hysteresis. Okay. So translated back in an active matter language, the question is, can the active rollers behave as salmons? Can they display polar order in the direction opposing the solvent flow? So that's the question I would like to answer now. And to answer this question, so we placed the colloids in a straight channel, and we applied an external solvent flow field in the direction opposing the spontaneous flow. And we measured the magnetization. And what we found is that indeed the emergent flows are hysteretic. We clearly have an almost rectangular hysteresis loop. So here you might have noticed that it's not perfectly rectangular. You have a slight decrease of the magnetization here, which is not due to the fact that the system is melting. The ridging of this bending is the buckling of the flow. At the onset of flow reversal, the spontaneous flow buckles. It forms stationary buckling patterns. And by further increasing the strength of the external field, the flow reverses, the oscillations are turned into vortices, and eventually all the colloids flow in the direction imposed by the solvent flow. So clearly, the width of the channel, the confinement, sets the wavelength of the buckling pattern. And maybe more importantly, confinement sets the amplitude of the hysteresis loop. So the magnitude of the coercitive field decreases as you increase the channel width. So the more confined, the more robust. So I now would like to understand why I have a hysteretic behavior and why does the coercitive field decreases with the channel width. So in principle, I would have to go back to Tourneur 2 hydrodynamics and solve this pattern formation problem in the presence of an external field. I don't know how to do that analytically. And as I don't know anything about numerics, I had to simplify the problem. So what we decided to do was simply to project the dynamics of the system on two modes only. An homogeneous longitudinal flow along x and a transverse perturbation at a given wavelength lambda. So by going from here to there, you turn a system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom to a system with only 2 degrees of freedom. In other words, you turn a pattern formation problem into a dynamical system problem, and you can actually fully solve this dynamical system. I'm going to spare you all the gory details, but let me just tell you that at a small field amplitude, you can indeed observe a stationary homogeneous flow opposing the H field. Above a critical field amplitude, which is exactly analogous to an Euler buckling threshold, the flow buckles. You have a stationary buckling pattern. The net current is still going in the direction opposite to the field. However, at even higher field amplitude, at above a critical value that is set by the competition between all the alignment interactions and the external field, the flow is reversed. As we listen to the fluid, we know all its hydrodynamic parameters, so those are the experiments, this is our theoretical prediction, the orders of magnitude are correct, and we were extremely happy with that given the crudeness of the two-mode approximation. So take a message, confinement and alignment interactions act together to stabilize the flow against external fields. Good. So now, is there something useful to do with this collective stubbornness, right? The colloids are stubborn. They want to go in the direction opposite of the direction you indicate them. So I learned that, like, during my military service when I was serving under the orders of General Pro, okay? I learned from this period of time that if generically, if you have a system with a force-velocity relation that has a hysteresis loop, and if you apply a position-dependent field, you can end up with function, and you can easily end up with spontaneous associations. And indeed, it happens. If you confine polar liquid droplets in circular wells. And if you apply an homogeneous DC flow field on top of them, you do see the droplets oscillating all at the same frequency. So how can you understand that from the bistable response? It's pretty straightforward. Let's say that you start with a droplet in the North Pole. It's pushed by the flow, so you are in this region. The droplet is happy to move in the direction of the tangential flow. Then it enters the South Pole, and it opposes the external field. You are here. At some point, the tension component of the flow is going to be too strong, and the system cannot resist the opposing flow. The system jumps towards the upper branch. The system reverses its direction of motion, happy in the South Pole, pushed by the flow, unhappy in the North Pole, and when it goes up north at this point, the system switches back to the bottom branch, and you explore periodically this hysteresis loop. So again, our Lilliputians are noisy, but that's cool because from their noise, you can infer, you can do an active sound spectroscopy and measure the hydrodynamics of the liquid they form. They are also stubborn, okay, which is also very convenient if you want to achieve a microfluidic function that you cannot achieve with Newtonian fluids. So I'm done with Lilliput. I would like to take you to this place, Brobdingnag. I'm not going to pronounce this word again, I promise. So that's a giant country. So I wish I could show you a movie of a flock of actual giants running. We didn't find enough of them. Let me just show you now what the biggest experiment I've ever conducted in my group. So that's the second system we'd like to talk about today, crowds. So this is a picture of the start area of the 2018 Chicago Marathon. And this system display many similarities with the colloidal rollers, obviously composed of active particles. They are at rest. And then you hit a key on your keyboard, and hop, spontaneous flow. Okay? Just the same. Straight geometry, unidirectional motion, many similarities. There is one capital difference, though. If you try to repeat the experiment, okay, you ask all the runners to go back there, pull the trigger, they would always go from the top to the bottom of the picture. No spontaneous symmetry breaking. Okay, they know where they want to go. That's really not a joke. That's a crucial difference between the two systems. And I'll come to that in a moment. So the question I would like to ask is it possible to infer the hydrodynamics of a human crowd by studying its fluctuation and its dynamic response, as I've just showed you in the case of colloidal rollers? So the key point is that I do not want to use any a priori behavioral knowledge about the interactions at the two-body, three-body, one-body level. I have no knowledge about human behavior, and yet I would like to establish a hydrodynamic theory of crowds. So the reason, that's because that's what we do when we like hydrodynamics. So now it's too late to talk about coffee, so let's talk about wine. When you want to describe the flow of wine in a glass of wine, you don't want to describe the exquisite details of the interaction between the water, the sugar, and the alcohol molecules. You just want to describe the hydrodynamics of this fluid viewed as a continuous medium. Good, and to do that, you need two things. You need conservation laws, and you need experimental measurements. And these experimental measurements are crucial to get the phenomenological relations that complete the conservation laws to establish hydrodynamics. So first thing first, let's talk about the measurements. So why marathon? Oh, I should have said that earlier. I'm not going to talk about this part of the race. All what I'm going to discuss today is what's happening here in the so-called start corrals, in the areas where the runners are guided towards the starting line. So why are we interested in this setting? First of all, because it's large. We are typically dealing with 5,000 runners out of a total of 4,000 40,000 runners for the Chicago Marathon. The geometry is simple, the motion is unidirectional, it's repeatable, you can go to Chicago every year, and there is no ethic issue with filming athletes running marathon. Those are obvious arguments in favor of filming marathons. If you are not a runner, you might not know that there is also a very good reason to be interested in the start goals. When the runners wait in the start goals, they are actually guided towards the starting line by a line of race officials, all wearing yellow vests. Okay. Yeah, I know. I don't want to discuss the color. I'm going to refrain myself to make any comment to you. So they are guided toward the starting line by these organizers wearing a yellow vest. And they are guided by repeated sequences of walk and stop and walk and stop motion. So in other words, we are dealing here with an active system on which we apply a repeated perturbation to a boundary. And the question is now, can I deduce the hydrodynamics of the crowd from its response to boundary perturbations? So here we go. This is the experimental setup. If you are not familiar with Chicago City, this is the park area. This must be the bean, I guess. This is the snake bridge. And this is the start of the Chicago Marathon. Okay. This was our lab. This is the hotel room. Okay. We picked the highest possible building. I had to use my suave voice when I made the reservation, asking to have the leftmost room in the hotel so that we could have a clear view on the marathon start. So the height of the hotel room is about 50 meters, and the distance to the marathon is 500 meters. So we had to work hard to correct for perspective distortions. So this is a bare image. This is an image in which the distances are analogous to the distances on the ground. And now that the images are corrected, you can do measurements. You can, for instance, measure density field. And I was very proud of having had this idea. I came up with a fantastic algorithm to measure the density. I showed up in the office of my student, and I asked him, count the people. Okay? Count the people on the pictures. Okay? And I was very proud that because he kept on talking to me afterwards, until the point where I asked him to give me error bars. Okay? And the problem is that the error bars were huge. And you can easily understand why by looking at this movie. Look at this guy. And this guy, oh, hey, up here. Here we go. And there's another one here, hidden. Okay. So he actually had to count the people on looped movies, and he did this for days, literally for days. He stopped talking to me. But what we found at the end was a pretty interesting result, at least to me. So this is the hydrostatics of a crowd. Here the people are walking. This is the velocity field. I'll tell you in a minute how we measure the velocity. It's just zero, nobody moves. And this is the density field. So this is the density, this is the distance to the starting line. The density is just flat. And I was very surprised by this, especially because here you cannot, obviously the crowd is bounded by the race officials. But here they are unbounded, they are something like 20 meters. They could expand. And you do not see any net gradient across the crowd. So that's the first crucial result. Importantly, this density, which is self-adjusted to 2.2 people per square meter, is extremely robust. In all the races that we quantitatively analyzed, we found 2.2. It's an extremely robust quantity. So fortunately, as far as the velocity field was concerned, we just have to we could use a conventional PIV technique that are very common in fluid mechanics, and by applying a slightly modified PIV algorithm, you can measure the velocity in the crowd. And needless to say that from this measurement, it's clear that velocity waves propagate upstream the ground. So we have velocity waves propagating upstream. They are triggered by the motion of the ray staff here. And interestingly, so this is two snapshots of the velocity wave. And interestingly enough, they are coupled to density waves. Peak of velocity, velocity peak, well in the density. Okay, so again, we have mixed modes combining velocity and density fluctuations. It's again very robust. So this is a spatiotemporal plot of the Chicago 2016 marathon. So this is a distance to the starting line. This is time. And the velocity here, that's the speed of the runners, average over the width of the road. Distance, time, and the color indicate the speed. Thanks to the yellow vests, we managed to track the position of the race staff. This is the trajectory, these are the trajectories of the race staff. And clearly, whenever the staff moves, the motion triggers the propagation of an upstream wave. Clearly, the slopes, those lines are just parallel, and the slopes, or equivalently the speed of sound in the system, is very narrowly peaked, around 1.2 meters per second. Good. Even more importantly, so this is the displacement of the line of race official that we could measure here. This is the response signal recorded 15 seconds later in the crowd. 30 seconds later, 45 seconds later, and 1 minute later, meaning hundreds of meters away from the initial perturbation. And you can see that the shape of the signal is virtually unchanged. In other words, the speed of the wave does not depend on the amplitude of the excitation, and there is very little damping. So this means that we are dealing with linear, non-dispersive waves. Fantastic, it's easy, we are back in our comfort zone. We can just apply the same techniques that we used with the colloidal rollers. We can now explore the full dispersion relation by picking up a given propagation direction, a given wave vector, and we can compute the power spectrum of the velocity, of the speed fluctuations. Oh, sorry, of the speed and of the orientational fluctuations. So what about the speed? So this is a power spectrum of the speed, pulsation, frequency, wave vector, boring, straight line. I just told you that that's a non-dispersive linear wave. So we have a very well-defined speed of sound. The question is now, does the speed of sound depend on the direction of propagation? So you can measure the speed of sound as a function of the direction of propagation. You get a peaked bell-shaped curve and adjust the cosine curve. In other words, you have upstream transport only. The dispersion relation is just omega equals velocity times qx, and that's it. So what about the damping? To measure the damping, you need to measure the width of the power spectrum. And what you can see is that the damping rate, the inverse of the relaxation time of the wave, is a quadratic function of the wave vector. In other words, we are dealing here with a diffusive damping. Question, how does the diffusion coefficient depend on the direction of propagation? Repeat the experiment for different directions of propagation. And what we find is that these variations are very nicely fitted by a cosine squared function. So the dynamic is genuinely one-dimensional. That's a slow 1D dynamics. The dispersion relation could not have been simpler than that. Okay, it's slow in the same spirit as what was explained at the end of Jean-François' lecture. There is no intrinsic time scale in this equation. You triple the size of the system, you multiply by 9 the relaxation time, and that's it. And you change accordingly the period of oscillation. What about what? D/C is a length scale. C is 1.2. D is 0.6, as far as I remember. So it's very short. That's why the waves are overdamped. Pardon?
The one,
exactly. Good. Orientational dynamics. So we are now looking at the fluctuations of the orientation of the velocity field. This is a spectrum. It's just fat and flat. No waves. The only thing that you can measure is the width of the spectrum. That tells you that, first of all, OK, orientational fluctuations are overdamped, no waves. You can measure the width, which gives you the relaxation time or the relaxation rate of the orientational fluctuations. And these variations are, again, quadratic. However, I'm not showing you here the angular variations. The diffusion occurs both in the x and y direction. So that's really 2D dynamics. But the dynamics is fast. You've got a gap here. And this gap tells you that you have the orientation of the crowd is a very fast mode, which is exactly the opposite of the concluding remark of Jean-François. OK. I'm not saying that he's wrong. He's absolutely right. So we have a fast 2D dynamics. Good. So now we made experiments. So in principle, we know the phenomenology. Now let's make use of conservation laws and symmetry arguments. No need of behavioral assumption to infer the hydrodynamics of a crowd. So I'm going to consider very naively, let's assume that I didn't attend to Jean-François's lecture. I'm going to consider three fields, density, velocity, and polarization. Polarization is just the local orientation of the people. I'm going to use an additional observation, which is just extremely robust. In the stock corals, people do not walk sideways. They don't do that. Okay, they just walk along the direction where they look at. Okay, good. So let's write down the hydrodynamics. Mass conservation, good. The current is just the product of density by the velocity, not a big deal. In principle, I can write down mass conservation. The mass and the acceleration equals the divergence of the stress plus all the body forces. And I can take advantage of my tiny knowledge of liquid crystal hydrodynamics to tell you that you can write the overdamped dynamics of the orientation, writing a co-rotational derivative and equal this co-rotational derivative with a body torque. So now what you have to do is to use your phenomenological observation to guess the form of the stress, the body force, and the body torque acting on the crowd. So here we go. What about momentum conservation? Let's begin with the stress. I want to look at what's going on at very large scales. So let's retain only the terms at lowest order in gradients. And the first term that you have in your stress is a pressure term, possibly an isotropic, but that's a pressure term. As I'm dealing here only with linear response, I can safely expand the pressure around the 2.2 people per square meter density and write down the gradient of the stress as a compressibility, a crowd compressibility times a density gradient. Good. So now, what about this? What's the body force? The body force is the actual friction that the people experience from the ground. This arises only from the friction with the ground. Again, in the spirit of a Landau-like expansion, you want to retain only the terms at lowest order in gradient, and they have to be linear functions of the velocity and of the local orientation. You can make an additional guess. You can make an additional guess by remembering the hydrostatics result. When you look at the hydrostatics, so no dynamics here, so this is momentum conservation, friction equals pressure gradient, the density was just flat. And for sure, the polarization was just maximal. Everybody, all the runners are looking towards the starting line. So this tells you immediately that this function here has to vanish for a given density. And this density is the equilibrium density of the crowd. So this is a regulation of the density at a given value. Okay, so what about the angular dynamics? So I told you that the orientational mode is a fast mode. okay? You have a relaxation in about one half of a second. So again, this tail and the relaxation occurs in the direction of the road, x. So again, this torque is, you can just write it at long wavelengths, at least as a linear combination between the direction of the road and the orientation of the people. And you are done. Game is over. You just take all these results, replace all these phenomenological equations into in mass conservation, and bam, you end up with the hydrodynamics of human crowd. You have only one hydrodynamic variable because you have only one slow field density. Velocity, the speed, is slave to density. That's why you can write equivalently the hydrodynamics in terms of the speed of the pedestrians. And that's just a convection diffusion equation. What you learn from this systematic analysis is that the speed of sound, of the wave speed, is given by the active friction force, and more precisely by its derivative. And surprisingly enough, the damping term here, the diffusive damping term, comes from the crowd compressibility. Whereas in room, compressibility is the model of the propagation. So the question now is all this specific to Chicago 2016, or is it more robust? So we set out to check this. We went back to Chicago in 2017. We went to Paris. Also, we also went to a massive race in Atlanta. We also been in Chicago in 2018. And here we go. Let's now it's time to check whether this crowd model is predictive or not. So this is the speed of the wave as a function of direction of propagation. Red dots, Chicago 2016. Black line, theoretical prediction, the theoretical fit. So this is bare data. All those are bare data, Chicago 2017, Paris, Atlanta. It's very robust. Okay, because, so it means, oh, by the way, I should also show you that the diffusive, the damping is definitely diffusive as well. So in other words, by measuring the response of a crowd in Chicago in 2016, you can actually predict the motion of a crowd in Paris in 2017 with pretty nice accuracy, provided that you look at the crowd motion at sufficiently large scales. Okay, so that was the last result I wanted to show you today. I hope that I've convinced you that the active hydrodynamic framework is particularly powerful to account for the large-scale motion of active materials, whether they spontaneously break rotational symmetry or whether rotational symmetry is explicitly broken. And the last thing I would like to add is that all this is a result of the hard work of three fantastic students: Alexandre Morin, who is now a postdoc at NYU, Nicolas Bain, who is now a postdoc at ETH in Zurich, and Delphine Gaillard, that your kids might meet next year as she'll be a physics teacher. With this, I thank you all for your attention and be happy to take any questions.